My peoples, welcome to Rants and Randomness. I'm Levy, your side-eye sorceress. And typically I bring you things I'm loving, things I'm side-eyeing, and something that makes me feel good. But sometimes I do a special episode when an interview is so good, it needs to stand on its own. And that's what we have here. On this episode, I'm talking to Courtney A. Kemp, co-creator and showrunner of the hit Starz TV show, Power. She's a force to be reckoned with and an influential Black woman in Hollywood, getting things done. She dropped so many gems that this interview needs to stand alone. She talked about growing up as the only Black woman in her city. She talked about why imposter syndrome doesn't psych her out and how she handles the challenges thrown at her. There are times in the interview when I wanted to jump out of my chair and run around because she was just preaching. Courtney is a straight shooter who knows her shit and she's not shy about it, and I love everything about her. I know you're gonna really enjoy this episode because I loved listening to it. So, also check out other standalone interviews that I've done on this podcast. Rich Dennis, episode 20. Yvette Noelle Shore, episode 23. Tashonda Brown Duckett, episode 29. My standalone interviews feel like masterclasses, and I'm thankful to everybody who joins me on this show. Courtney, thank you for joining me. But first, let me drop this new hot podcast on you. Shout out to this episode's sponsor, The Sugar. It's a new podcast you should check out. It's a show for modern women of color, and it's hosted by chocolate goddess Tika Sumter. You might know her as a model or from the hit show Mixed Dish or one of her other movie roles. Her co-host is Ty Randolph, who is an award-winning business exec and is one of the head of Kevin Hart's LOL Network. Every week, Tika and Ty invite a woman of color to talk about their unique perspective on motherhood, love, friendship, and everything in between. The Sugar is made for and by the modern brown mama. They wanted to make sure there was safe space for all women, moms, moms-to-be, and those undecided to laugh, learn, and love on each other as they navigate life. You can listen to The Sugar now in your favorite podcast app and make sure to subscribe and favorite. Search for The Sugar. That's S-U-G-A. Now on to my interview with Courtney. Hey, Courtney.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Just trying to figure out if I'm going to go to New York tomorrow.
Oh, my gosh. Girl, I
this
can't.
This is crazy, man.
This is nuts. Nuts. But thank you for making time.
Of course. Are you kidding me? I'm a huge fan.
So. Oh, man. This is exciting. Mark, does she sound good? Oh, we're all good? All right. All right. So I'm continuing with the roster of amazing women during Women's History Month. And we have a powerhouse Black woman making history and entertainment on the show today, Courtney A. Kemp. Courtney, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you so much for having me.
Let me give people your bio because your epicness is real. Courtney A. Kemp is a television writer and producer. In 2014, she created the Starz series Power, which just had a series finale and is the most watched original series on Starz with millions of viewers and has several spinoff shows in production right now, like five. She was also a writer on shows like The Bernie Mac Show, The Good Wife, and Beauty and the Beast. Courtney is one of the most powerful women in television, and I am excited to have her on Rants and Randomness. Courtney, thank you for coming on.
It's my pleasure, and I'm really excited, to be honest with you. Like, I'm super excited to be
So I always start by asking my guests, what did you want to do or be when you were growing up?
I've been writing and making up stories since I was a very little girl. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd probably say, like, 4 or 5.
Wow.
Really started playing... Yeah, definitely. I've always been a storyteller. My mom, you know, kind of laughs about it. And I see it now in my own daughter. We have a lot of fun making up stories. But I started that back then. And then when I was in high school, I started reading James Baldwin. Mm. And I thought, oh, I really want to be a novelist.
Okay.
And my dad said, no, you're going to be a lawyer instead. And I said, okay, I really like the law as it is on TV. But when I went to college, I just stayed with my love of words. And I went to college for English Lit and Modern Culture and Media Studies, which at Brown was like the study of film. And it's really funny because I never took the production classes at Brown because I was like, I'm never going to make a movie. I'm never going to make TV. I just want to talk about it. And then all these years later, here I am with like so much TV I'm making, I could hardly handle it.
I mean, you are, again, there are several queens of television. You're definitely one of them. Do you find any old stories you used to write, like when you were young?
I do find them. They're all very sad. It's really interesting. Like everything I wrote in high school was really sad and had sad endings. In middle school, I won a state prize for an article I wrote about being the only Black person or one of the few Black people in my high school. But I won an award in middle school for a story I wrote about a nuclear holocaust. And the end of that story is like the last pieces of nuclear winter fall on the last plant. And it's like the last thing that dies for the group of people that have been hiding underground. I mean, it's really sad stuff. And I guess it's funny because when we killed Raina on the show, spoiler alert for anyone who doesn't watch Power, but when we killed Raina, a lot of people said to me, oh, that's so sad. And I was like, really? It feels kind of like what would happen to me. But I do kind of have a history of writing stuff that doesn't have happy endings. Sorry, everybody.
So wait, how were you as a kid when you were writing these stories? What was your personality like?
I was always loud. I mean, I'm a Kemp. We're all loud and very sort of boisterous and funny. But I was also pretty introspective. You know, I think anytime you grow up and there aren't a lot of people who look like you around you, mm-hmm. you do feel different. So I felt different, you know, and that was something that I really couldn't share with a lot of people because they weren't like me and they didn't understand. And I didn't really fit in groups of people of color at that age either, because I didn't have any of their cultural references. I was kind of on an island by myself. And so, I mean, that's a great question. What was I like? I was a musician.
Okay.
I was, you know, working very hard on singing and on piano and clarinet. I was writing a lot. I was getting straight A's. I was doing a lot of musicals, you know. I mean, I was reading a lot of theater, reading a lot of plays. I was reading a lot. I mean, I think that's like the best answer is I was reading a lot. But I mean, I had friends and all these things. But I had like the theater kids. But I wasn't a cheerleader. I wasn't like on a sports team. I wasn't having that experience. I wasn't having the like typical Connecticut high school experience.
Ah, Connecticut. What city?
It's called Westport. It's now it's a little bit more diverse, but at that time in the 80s, you know, we're talking Reagan era, definitely not such a diverse place to be. And everyone was a Republican. And I remember I went to school with a Mondale Ferraro button on my jean jacket and like I got mocked. I had two big Afro puffs at that time and
yes.
all the kids called me Minnie Mouse. I mean, it was like, it's fine now. Like I look back on it and I laugh, but I definitely remember that differentness, that separateness and how I really couldn't wait to find people who were like me when I got out.
And how did your parents handle that basically being on your own island?
Well, it was their call. You know, my dad really, you know, when he was a younger man, all the executives where he worked, because he worked at General Foods and then he worked at various advertising agencies, all the executives lived outside New York City. They lived in Westport and Fairfield and all those towns and, you know, New Rochelle and Scarsdale. And so that was his goal. He was like, I'm just as good as these white guys. I'm going to have a house out there. I'm going to raise my family out there just like they do. Which I understand. Mm-hmm. That was where he was coming mm-hmm. from. And then he, I guess he moved us out there thinking, okay, you're going to get this great education and you're going to have all the advantages that white kids do. But we weren't white kids. So there were some losses, you know, there were some gains and losses. I think my mom tried to like stitch it together with Jack and Jill a little bit.
Okay.
But I think my dad was much more, like, look, you're getting this advantage. And because he grew up with all Black people, as did my mom grew up in segregation. I really think that my dad kind of felt like, oh, you'll get over it. Like Blackness is something, not something that you learn, it's something that you are. Well, that is true to some extent. But I think as I grew older, I really self-selected into an African-American identity. But not everybody does that, though.
Facts.
That was like a choice.
Facts.
But I was always yearning for more of people like myself, you know? One of the things that I am always sad about is that with other Black women my age, I didn't grow up braiding hair. I didn't grow up doing other people's hair. Mm. You know, I didn't grow up with all of that. So it's like I missed certain things. And I always laugh with people and I say, oh, I wasn't really Black until 1994 because I graduated high school. And then when I went to college, that's when I sort of found people. But I had to leave my hometown to do it.
How did you pick Brown? What made you pick that as your undergrad?
My dad said, I will pay for any Ivy League school. So you can apply to these eight schools. Other than that, I'm not paying. So I wanted to go to like Sarah Lawrence or Bard or someplace that was about writing. And my dad was like, nope, you're not going to any of these silly little liberal arts schools to get a degree in nothing. Mm. So when I looked at all those Ivy League schools, Brown was the one that had like a creative writing program. And like, they were very much like, hey, don't worry about core curriculum. You don't have to take math, whatever. You don't have to do that. So it was kind of perfect for me. And then when I visited the campus, I fell in love with it. And it wasn't that far from home too. There were a lot of advantages to that. It was only like 3 hours from home. Not that I wanted to be close to them, but they wanted me to be close to them. Because at first, when they said that, I was like, which one is furthest away?
Like, you're like, how far can I run?
Like, how far can I? I was like, is Cornell far enough? Like, where's far enough? So kind of a funny story in that way. But that's why I picked Brown, for sure.
College for me was life-changing in that it kind of changed the way I looked at the world. What was college? What did you think you learned the most in college?
Oh, God, I learned so many things. I mean, I wish I could talk to my college-age self, though.
What would you say?
I really wish I could. I would say, girl, your eating disorder is troubling. Let us get us some help for that now-ish. I would say, you know, having a man is not the most important thing. You don't need that. Not right now. You're in your early 20s. Go live. Go to France. You know, I didn't go to my exchange program. I was fluent in French at the time. I barely use it now, but I was fluent in French at the time. I really wanted to go to France on a student exchange my junior year. And my boyfriend at the time was like, well, I'm not going to wait for you. So if you go, we have to break up. And so I didn't go. Oh. Like, I wish I could slap my old self upside the head and be like, bitch, get on that plane.
Get on the plane.
But it's like, but of course we don't know these things when we're teenagers. I guess that the thing, most important thing I learned is that education changes class. Hmm. You know, that you become middle class through your education, no matter what. So even though, because my friends who came from less affluent backgrounds, they would talk to me all the time about how going home changed for them because they had seen a new kind of the world, part of the world, not Rhode Island, but through books, through education, through being around people who had a different experience in life.
Man, so let's dig into that. Like, how did you end up having an eating disorder? What happened that basically was the catalyst for that?
It's a great question, and it's something that's not talked about in our community at all. I mean, there's so many things around mental health and depression, anxiety, all those things that people do not talk about in our community, and I find it to be, like, this is how we die. How we die as a community is because we don't talk about these things, because once we don't talk about them, we don't talk about mental health, we don't talk about addiction, we don't talk about any of that stuff, and so then people sink deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah.
And there's such a stigma against therapy, against talking to anybody but your, you know, preacher about things, that it really becomes something that people just, that's how people get hurt, right? Because they use sex, or they use alcohol, or they use drugs, or they use other things to cope with those feelings. If they address the feelings, potentially they wouldn't have to use those things. And I do feel like it's one of the great sort of sorrows of our community that we're not allowed to talk about, hey, I think I have problems. I think I have trauma. Right. I think I need help. But the eating disorder thing just comes from, again, I was raised in perfectionism. I was raised in, like, straight A's are the only way. Again, I was isolated because of my race. I looked different. And it's not uncommon for young women to become anorexic based on wanting to disappear.
Right.
Wanting to not be seen because I was so highly visible. I was so highly visible, Lovey. I couldn't hide.
There was no hiding.
Because I just, so there was this kind of thing. And I think, you know, it's not uncommon with women of color. It's just that we don't talk about it.
Hmm. And I know, well, part of the whole not hiding thing, besides the fact that you're Black, you're also not 5'2 and 100 pounds.
100%.
Right? So
100%.
In the 80s and the 90s, yep. This was not the time when people celebrated you being different or anything besides what is considered the standard of beauty. So how did you...
I mean, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all. And I had this, I had that profound moment, too, of, like, the first Black Miss America, and then they took away her title.
Mm,
you remember?
Oh, yes.
And so Vanessa, to me, like, it was, like, that little moment of, like, oh, look at us for 5 seconds. Or, you know, and then they took it away. Or, like, there were moments of my childhood where seeing people who looked like me on television, like, oh, look, there's FloJo, there's Jackie Joyner Kersee. Like, there were moments, right?
Yeah.
Moments where we would pop up. I know you're younger than I am, but it's not like it is now for my daughter, or even not even my daughters, because my daughter's 9, but like girls who are in their 20s now, they have seen so many different kinds of us and shapes of us. Like if I had had a Mara La Negra when I was 16, I would have felt totally different about what I looked like at that time. But no, I'm not a little person. I'm not a quiet person, ultimately. Like I'm a pretty, so it was hard for me to hide anyway.
You take up space, and we're supposed to take up space. But again, this is a new concept. The permission to take up space is new. How did that affect your college experience as you're going through this?
I was pretty arrogant about my intelligence at that time. So I'm sorry to those of you who went to college with me if I felt the need to tell you about yourself and how wrong you were. In a sociology class, probably that was me. Like, I was the person who when, like, a person who was, I use the phrase non-Black, a person who was non-Black made a comment about people of color. I was like, no, you're wrong. Let me explain to you why you don't know what you're talking about. Boop. You know what I mean? I was that guy a little bit. But that was part of identity politics at that time. I went to college in, like, the mid to late 90s. You know, it was... Identity politics was all about that. It was just so, I mean, it was so deep. And not only identity politics around race, but around gender, around sexuality. I mean, all of that stuff was coming to the fore at that time. So I think, you know, I think I was pretty stringent, pretty political, for sure. You know, I mean, I was definitely more of a Freddie than I was a Denise.
Yes. Come on, a different world.
But I also, yes, exactly. But yeah, I think that probably describes me. It's so funny that we're talking about this because it's not one that we were going to talk about. But what were you like?
Oh, my God. In college? Oh, man. Kind of similar. I mean, college is when I actually started blogging. So I probably thought my life was way more interesting than it was. Because I would blog about, like, undergrad life, and I'd write about whatever exams I wasn't studying for. I took myself very seriously. But I was goofy, and it was my first time being by myself, too. So I kind of discovered who I was without parental supervision. But funny enough, who I am without parental supervision was very close to who I was with parents. I was still very like, I got to make sure I'm going to class. I got to make sure I'm not failing out of college. I got to make sure that I'm being responsible. But my major was in psychology. And yours was what, English Lit?
Mm. Yeah, English and American Literature.
Mm-hmm. See, I was like, I'm supposed to be a doctor because, you know, Nigerian girl. That didn't happen. But I think I was still convicted to, like, not do something that was liberal arts.
What gave
you the confidence?
Oh, sorry. Well, I was going to say my ex-husband is, his dad is from Ghana. And so I was kind of in that whole world for a long time because we were together for 20 years. And the kind of that pressure on the kids of African immigrants, of West African immigrants to be perfect, to succeed. It's like as bad, if not worse, than what I was going through.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine being a girl in that situation. My ex-husband is a man, and it was so hard. I mean, I just watched that, and I was like, wow. And he's an attorney. you know, he did all the things he was supposed to do. Check marks, check marks, check marks, right? He played like college football. He did all the things. But it's interesting. It's like you make, you do all the things that you're supposed to do because, and then it's ingrained in you, you know? So it's like my dad has been deceased now since 2011. Mm. I still basically am trying to get an A so I can please him when it comes right down to it. Like in the basics of my DNA, I'm still trying to say, Dad, are you proud of me yet? Mm. You know? And it's fundamental.
Shout out to this episode's sponsor, The Sugar. It's a new podcast you should check out, and it's about modern women of color for modern women of color. It's hosted by Tika Sumter, and you might know her as a model or from the hit show Mixed-ish or one of her other movie roles. Her co-host is Ty Randolph, who is an award-winning business executive. And every week, Tika and Ty invite a woman of color to talk about their unique perspective on motherhood, love, friendship, and everything in between. The Sugar is made for and by the modern brown mama. They wanted to make a safe space for all women, moms, moms-to-be, and those undecided to laugh, learn, and love on each other as they navigate life. So listen to The Sugar on your favorite podcast app and make sure to subscribe and favorite it. Search for The Sugar. That's S-U-G-A.
So you graduated with the English Lit as your major.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do next?
I went to Columbia University in the PhD program for English Lit. And then I got a master's there and left because it was too isolating. I like people too much to be like in a carol writing basically a book about, I was doing my work in Jane Austen at that time.
Oh, wow.
I refused to do African-American literature because it was like everywhere I went. And then again, this is 1998 into 1999. So it's the height of identity politics. Anywhere I went, the people were like, oh, you're in English literature. Are you doing African-American lit? And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm not doing African-American lit. Because I look like this, it doesn't mean that's what I'm doing. I read African-American lit. And I remember once I had this, my advisor, because I was doing the 1800s, because I was doing that time period, the advisor they gave me was a guy who had done all that work. And he was like, you don't just seem like someone who wants to do this work. And I was like, I know I don't seem like that, but why? And he was like, well, I'm just saying, it just seems like you would be more into African-American lit. Like he said it, he really said it. Like he just actually said it. And he wasn't the first person. So this had been building up. And I said to him, I live African-American literature. I don't need to read it.
Hmm. Well.
And he was like, ooh. And of course, I was reading African-American lit, but it wasn't, that was what I was doing to feed my soul, not to do my work. And so then my work was on Jane Austen. I wrote my.
That's what I was doing to feed my soul, not to do my
mouth
work.
I had a big for a while.
Yes.
I have a big mouth. Always.
I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Hold on. I have to, sorry. Okay. I have to tell people to leave me alone. So there's like two shows shooting right now. So Ghost is shooting right now in New York and Raising Kanan is shooting right now in New York.
Oh my God.
So there's, I'm getting these like consistent text messages about what's happening on set and like crises after crises like popping off. And I always tell people like, I'm not available for this period of time, but nobody cares. Nobody cares about that.
No, this is also valid because how did you go from writing about, you know, Jane Austen to where you are now? I want to know that journey because it's so fascinating to me that you went from doing that to doing this.
Well, okay, it's funny because first of all, the answer to a lot of your questions is God. Like that's really how it happened because I was aiming in this whole new different direction. So I was setting out to be the first Black editor-in-chief of Vogue. That's really what I wanted. I love fashion. I love style. I love beauty. I love skin. I love hair. I love all that. So that was like kind of what I really wanted to do. And I was very thin, remember, anorexia. So I was like really kind of, that's where I was going. And I left Columbia with my master's degree and went to Condé Nast. And worked at Mademoiselle, and then I worked at GQ after that, and I was really trying to get my way into Vogue. And when I was at GQ, I wrote an article about interracial dating for the magazine. And it was funny because I really had dated mostly white guys, obviously, considering where I was, until I met my ex-husband. Mostly, not entirely, but until I met my ex-husband, and then we were just together and got married. And so I'd written this kind of funny tongue-in-cheek piece about, like, don't take your, like, it was written to white men about dating black women. I was like, don't take her out for fried chicken, blah, 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 ha, ha, ha. And then they, that went out in the September 2001 issue of GQ, which means nobody read it because the world exploded in September 2001.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought that nobody read it. But it turns out these two writers named Chris Alberghini and Mike Chesler, who I'm still friends with, they had read it and they wanted to turn my little story into a TV show. And that didn't actually happen, but we ended up creating a show and then going to pitch it at HBO. And HBO did buy it, but I learned, like, oh, this is what I want to do. So I always wanted to write, right? I always wanted to be a novelist and all these things. But I really didn't realize that that's what it was. And I think this is true of every successful person. I know it's true of you. There was a moment then where I had to leap on, and walk out on faith. So I moved to California, and I have to give my ex-husband a lot of credit here. He was like, well, if this is what you're going to do, we can't stay here. We can't stay in New York. Now you can live in New York and be a television writer, but it's harder. Then it was impossible. So we had to move to LA. And so I moved out here. I didn't know how to drive really. It was just like, it all had to happen then basically. And so I moved. I started working for a travel agent. I had an agent when I moved out here because of the article. I had an agent. Her name's Nancy S. She's still my agent. Although technically I had to fire her a few months ago, but we could talk about that separately because of the Writers Guild. And I don't know if your listeners know about the Writers Guild. And
they don't. Union. We haven't talked about that.
So it's just that the Writers Guild of America, our leadership a while ago decided that we had to fire our agents because of the way that they make money off of us as writers. And so we had to do all that. But Nancy really believed in me. And she said, look, you're going to get a job out here, so move out here. And then I did. And then I started, that was June 16th, 2004, when I moved out. And in August, I started working on the Bernie Mac show. Very lucky. Yeah. And I will tell you, I wrote a spec Bernie Mac and they hired me off of that. And I'm going to tell you that never happened, but that was God. That is God. Here's the thing.
Wow.
It's that whole thing about, like, you have to do the footwork, but then God will make sure that your feet land where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved. If I hadn't moved, then the story would be very different. But I moved.
Wow.
And so God was like, okay, I'll meet you more than halfway. And that happened. And then I will also just say for the listener, so I worked the first year of Bernie Mac and then I got fired because I wasn't funny.
Let's talk about that. Word?
Straight up wasn't funny. How about that? And there were other things that happened too. Like, and I just told you, like, temps, for the most part, were very loud and were very funny. So I thought, I was like, I got this. No, I do not got it. I didn't know how to navigate the politics. I didn't know how to, like, be in the world. I just didn't know how to do all those things. I didn't have the emotional maturity. I was still like a child in a lot of ways and didn't know how to do it. You know, I was so used to being the person who put her hand up first. I just didn't know how to, like, sit quietly and learn. And I didn't know how to kind of get along. I really wish I could hug that version of me, you know, 26, 27 year old me. I would really like to give her a hug and just say, oh girl, you're going to figure this out. It's going to take some time.
Do you remember what they told you when they fired you?
Well, they don't fire you directly.
Okay.
They call your agent and they say they're not asking you back.
Mm.
But I remember that phone call. Whoa. I remember where I was sitting. And I remember being like, okay, well, I don't want to fucking work for them anyway. You know, I had a little bit of an attitude, but then also it was my first big failure in life. Because I was so proud. I was working on a show that my parents actually liked. I was making like $120,000 a year, which was a huge, huge amount of money, huge step from where I had been. I was like, really? I mean, my dad had sort of bet against me when I moved out there. He said, well, don't move out there because you'll be back in a year.
Ooh,
and,
ouch.
And I moved. Yeah, but that was the thing. He wanted me to be a lawyer. What the fuck is this moving to TV, to California to be a TV writer? What
right.
is that about?
Which is pipe dreams.
You understand?
Which is pipe dreams for real.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And he's like, you're a black woman. No one's going to let you do that.
Mm.
And he's right. People didn't let me do it. I had to, like, kick doors down and punch my way through. But he was a pioneer in his own way. And I think that was actually very inspiring to me. But to go back, so I had written, coming off of that, Nancy said to me, well, do you really want to write comedy?
Hmm.
Is that really what you want to do? And I said, no, I don't even watch comedy, because I didn't. I didn't. I watched Law and Order and, like, you know, those kind of things. I watched, dramas. And so she said, okay, well, write a drama spec. And I wrote a CSI, and that got me hired on a show called Injustice, which is the first show that Robert and Michelle King created for ABC. And Robert and Michelle went on to create The Good Wife, and I worked for them for 3 years on that later. But after that, after leaving comedy to go to drama, I worked every year consistently from then until now in TV. I never had a year where I sat out. I was always working, and I was very fortunate. I mean, shows got canceled, certainly,
right.
and we had a strike, but I always worked because I finally got it. I was in the right place doing the right thing at the right time. And I was two for a lot. You know, they'd be like, they'd hire, back in the day, in that time, they would hire all their white straight men first.
Mm-hmm, of course.
And then they would go, we need a woman or we need a person of color. And sometimes, Levy, I got the job because I was both.
Say more.
And then, what?
You say you got the job because you were broke or booked?
Both, meaning they needed someone who was of color or they needed a woman. Like, they would hire if there were 9 seats in the room, they would hire 8 straight white guys, and then they would go, oh, we need a woman, or oh, we need a person of color. Not because they wanted to, but because they needed to look diverse to the studio.
Oh,
and so what would happen is they would meet me and they'd go, great, if we hire her, we don't have to try to hire an additional one.
You are a twofer.
I was twofer, exactly. I was twofer.
So what was your approach whenever you end up on these sets, even if you knew that they hired you for that reason?
Oh, that doesn't matter. I mean, it's so funny. It's like when I hear young people, millennials, they're like, I can't believe he just said that to me. Like, he just said that he hired me because I'm a woman. So the fuck what? Go in and do your due.
Come on.
Like, who cares why the door opens? I don't care why the door opens. The door opened. I'm walking through it. I don't care. Like, people's shit is so misplaced to me. Can I curse?
You can. You can. It's fine.
but it is people's concern about why they're in the room boggles my mind. I don't care why I'm in the room. I'm in the room.
I love that, because a lot of people have the imposter syndrome of, like, oh my God, do I belong here? So they make it affect what they do and how they show up. You're saying it doesn't even matter whether or not you think you belong there. Just get the job done.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
I like that. That is
correct.
A new perspective I've not heard from a lot of people. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just think it's like you can't, the imposter syndrome thing for me has never been, that's never been really a thing for me. I have it sometimes, of course, personally, I have that. But when it comes to the greater, like, how do I put this? When it comes to corporate structure,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to, the traditional powers that be who have been in power for a long time, when it comes to them looking at me, I don't have imposter syndrome.
Mm.
Because I know I'm being underestimated. And I had Dre say this. On Power, and I think I had Ghost maybe say it to him at one point, but being underestimated is the best thing that can ever happen to you in business. It's the best thing. You want people to look at you and go, oh, she can't do that. You want that. You want that.
And why?
Because then you blow them away with your excellence, and then they're surprised, and you have the element of surprise.
Mm-hmm.
You get to shock people,
mm-hmm.
and you get to prove them wrong. You always want people to go on record saying you can't do something.
Yes.
Go on record. Yes. do it, please, yes, say. She can't do that. Fabulous. Because then when I prove you wrong, not only do I look like a star, but you look like a fool, and I didn't have to do anything to you.
Girl, that's a preach. That is a preach. Oh, I love that. I love that. Because we're constantly stuck in this whole, people don't expect a lot from me. Let them not expect nothing from you. And then blow them out the water.
Invite them to all day long, you know, invite them to think that you're less than. I had a conversation with, it was so funny. I was doing this show called Get Christy Love, which didn't end up being picked up by ABC, but it was a great experience. I was on a phone call and a person on the call said, and I'm not going to name names, but person on the call said, well, this network or this person, we were talking about a whole bunch of different networks. This network will never do this for you because they've never done it before. Hmm. And I said, that has nothing to do with anything. That is not at all relevant.
Yep.
I've never been relevant. I have never, if precedent was what we were talking about, Power never would have done the numbers it's done for Stars. So I am not precedential. And when you talk about me and when you think about me, don't think about precedent. Think about how far we can go, not how low it has been in the past. And that woman, of course, you know, who was on that call, I don't know that she loved that I said that, but she turned out to be wrong.
Mm.
And people have a tendency to turn out to be wrong, but I don't like to call them on it. I like to say, in my best and highest self, when I'm closest to my higher power, what I say to people is, okay, maybe you're right.
Hmm.
You know, and I let them be them.
Wow. And then you do your job and then you kill it. You kill it.
You try.
So when Power started in 2014, first of all, where did you get the idea of Power? How did the whole Power thing happen? Because that show, like, me and my husband sit there binge watching it on some, like, we are dedicating the day to watching episodes to catching up. If we weren't, Power became a powerhouse on TV. How did that whole thing happen?
Again, the answer is God, because you are not in the results business. So you work as hard as you can and leave it all in the field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whatever people can do, like whatever people do with that, they do with that. You can't make people watch your television show. This is what I say to young people all the time. You can, even if you get it on the air, people still have to turn it on. And there's so much content now that people have to choose you.
Right.
What I will tell you though, Lovey, is that we came on at a very specific time where there weren't a lot of shows with people like us in the leads. And it was before this whole revolution, right? Because it was us, we came on, and then Empire came on about 6 months later or maybe 4 months later. And so that was the beginning kind of all of this. And so people started to watch it, and then it just grew from there, word of mouth. I mean, that's how the juggernaut happened. I personally cannot take credit for all the people that watched. What I say is I did have to fight my network on certain things, certain kinds of storytelling. I was like, I'm going to be authentic to the experience of people of color. I'm going to be authentic to New York. So it's going to be intensely diverse, not just Black or Latin, but also Asian, you know, also like we did everything. And we did, you know, different kinds of everything. We did, you know, we did in terms of white people, we had diversity because we did Albanians, we did Serbians. We were doing what was happening in New York at the time, literally, not somebody's idea of what New York is. And I think that helped, very much helped us. Very early on, I decided that the Spanish would be specific and that for the most part, I would cast Puerto Rican actors as Puerto Rican, Dominican actors as Dominican, Cuban actors as Cuban. For the most part, I did that. And then we had Spanish dialect coaches who really made the dialect specific to where people were from. Not this bullshit, like, Colombian actor playing a Mexican with no change in accent. That's not real, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think because we were able to do those things very early and because I was trying to innovate, you know, I was trying to say, let's make this as close to what it should be as it is.
What made you want to tell that particular story of Ghost, Tommy, and all their doings?
Well, first of all, I was writing about my dad. This story is out there, but I was writing about my father's obsession with like image because he was in advertising. So he was always advertising himself. And he always said to us, if you smell good and you look good and you sound good, white people will give you a shot. And that's where he was coming from. He was born in 1941. And so that's where he was coming from. And I think Ghost is that closet of ghosts that you see in the opening. Ooh. That was my dad's closet. Growing up, he had this long closet with all these suits. He had beautiful suits, like suit after suit, shirt after shirt, pocket square after pocket square. He had all these clothes. And he was always transforming himself. He kept himself in good shape. So he was always kind of transforming himself to be the most perfect iteration of himself. And I think that's part of what was. He had just died in March of that year. He died March 5th, 2011. And so I was writing about him. And then I took him plus 50. So I took 50's story of having been a drug dealer and having come out on the other side. And in 50's specific case, it's interesting. So my dad went to Amos Tuck Business School at Dartmouth. He was the first black man to graduate from there.
Okay.
50, if you get to talk to him, is basically a Fortune 500 CEO, really in his brain. And if 50 had been born and raised where I was born and raised, he would have gone to Wharton Business School in the same way that I went to Columbia for graduate school. Like, he would be this titan of industry. And he is, in his own way. But I think it's like, this is the thing about people having opportunities. This is the other reason that I don't have that imposter syndrome when we're talking about the larger, more traditional, more conventional, more mainstream people who have been in charge, is that I went to the same schools they did. And I got the same A's they did. So I'm not intimidated. I'm like, yeah, and.
You're like,
so
I have the pedigree and the credentials.
Right. I know Buffy and Muffy. I went to their summer house too. Let's move on. I think when you would look at someone like 50 who doesn't have that educational background, but is so smart and so strategic. I mean, I think it's like my dad is kind of a blend of those both, because he grew up kind of in the hood, but also was brilliant and got himself all the way to the Ivy League from that. And I think that, I guess I wanted to blend those two things. So that's where the story really comes from. It comes from the Breaking Good. I always used to say it's Breaking Good. It had Breaking Bad on TV for a while, and I was like, so what is the other version? And then to tell you the truth, I really wanted to write about Ghost's original iteration. He was an alcoholic in recovery.
Okay.
He was in a 12-step program, and that I was told that the audience wouldn't find that relatable. So we took that, the very specifics of that out of the show. But Ghost's struggle with alcohol is still pretty present in the show, if you remember.
He's drinking.
Kind of mess up a lot of times with alcohol.
Yeah, like he'll get drunk and say something crazy, do something crazy, act the fool. Wow. See, I actually hadn't heard that story of how Ghost came to be that character. And then Tommy, you created this TV show that I'm pretty sure your audience was mad diverse too, which is also in itself a gift, because a lot of times TV shows are marketed as, oh, this is a black show, this is a white show, this is a show for these people. As the show was going along, did you receive any other type of pushback that you had to fight, or were you given creative control, full creative control?
There's no such thing as full creative control in television. Mm. And anyone who tells you they have full creative control is lying.
Good to
unless
know.
They have a YouTube channel.
Good to know.
But no, I mean, I always had notes. They were always pieces of the process that I got pushback on. The show did not start out with an incredibly diverse audience. It started out with a black audience because the original poster was Omari holding a gun, and it said from executive producer 50 Cent. I've always said this, that I am so happy that they put from executive producer Curtis 50 Cent Jackson on the poster. I just wish that they had foregrounded the suit more, because what they did was that they kind of were like, yo, hip hop audience, this is for you. And I had a white friend of mine, a white male friend of mine, say, I'm not going to watch that show. I'm from that poster. Why would I watch it? It's not for me. And the show was about the American dream. The show was at its fundamental. And this is something I say to young writers all the time. If your show is not about a universal question, you have the wrong show. So the universal question in Power is, does my past dictate my future?
Wow.
Which is a big part of the American dream, which is, can I transform, right? That's what we're all about here in America. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We can change. Yep. You think about how absurd it is that one of our fundamental texts has the word happiness in it. That's how silly we are. That we are like, we think we have the right to be happy.
Yeah.
But happiness sometimes has to do with pre-creation, self-image. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I write as I have slaves. I write this as I have slaves. So what does that mean? It means that I'm creating in myself an image of a perfect statesman, but I'm ignoring the fact that I actually am not this at all.
That's a word.
So, sorry to get deep.
No, please get deep. I'm like, you basically giving a masterclass right now. Continue.
But so my point is, the question of your series always has to be universal. Does my past dictate my future? That is a question that everyone can ask themselves. Black, white, Asian, Native, no matter what. If you are a Native American woman who lives on the res and you have figured out some way to get yourself into a great school and you've moved away from home, home is still in you. But maybe you want to transform and be something that you can bring back and help other people. That still does my past dictate my future. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, those things are all in there. And so at the first, STARS was like, let's get the low-hanging fruit. This is what my former boss, Chris Albrecht, said to me. He's like, I protested. I said, why is this poster? Why is it this? Why is it this? Why are you not marketing this show more widely? Why is this show not being brought to the attention of people who are non-Black? And he said to me, let's get the low-hanging fruit first. Let's get the people who we know are going to watch the show first. And I still disagree with that. Fundamentally, emotionally, I felt that was such a rejection of the quality of the program that I was putting forward. But I also understand that from his perspective, he was like, I need to grow this audience. And there's another piece of it. And 50 always says this too. Black people define cool.
We do.
We find something and we say this is cool and then other people do it.
It's true. This is facts. Actual factual. But did you ever feel... Did you ever feel a way about... There are times when people forget that there's actually a showrunner behind this. 50 is an executive producer. There are times that I've seen you be erased. How have you... Have you dealt with that? Have you even... Does it matter to you?
A couple of different answers to that. Most of the time, as writers... I mean, I was a journalist, too, so... there's a bit of being a journalist that is about, like, don't look at me. Look at the subject, right? Like, even in our conversation right now, as much as this is your show, you're doing this thing that I would be doing if I had mine, which is asking the other person the questions and trying to get, because this is that moment for your audience to be able to talk to me, right? So I feel as though part of it is that a core of our audience are 50 fans. And 50 is the face because, in a way, that's the thing he enjoys. I don't like being on camera. I don't like doing all that. That's not really me. I can't really deal with the public in that way. Like, the people are like, Ed, how is you, 50? He's like, yeah. He gets them right back. Like, he's really good at the clapbacks and all that. Like, that's not for me. I don't really want to do that. I'm busy show running and being a mom.
Which makes sense.
I can't do all that. So part of it is that that's really great marketing. It works best. Part of it is that when I've been on the, like, 50 most powerful showrunners list or some of these other lists on Variety and all those things, and it's really about your peer group to some extent, and it's really about what is going to allow you to do more work. As you well know, when you wrote the book, it's like you wrote the book, and then that allowed you to do more work, and that more work begat more work.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yep.
So really the question is, what gives me more work? And I guess that is ultimately what it is. Yeah, I don't care so much as, like, I'm the showrunner of the show. I want to deal with other showrunners. I want to talk to other showrunners. I want to be able to run more shows. And I feel like that's kind of where the impact is. And then anyone who wants to find me or wants to see me, I'm out there. You know, I'm on Instagram or whatever. But if you are a young writer and you want advice about writing, or you're a mom and you want to talk about, like, the crush of being, like, a working mom and trying to hold down a job and be a good parent, I mean, I'm there for you. You can find me. But I don't feel so much erased as I feel like I do what I do, if he does what he does, and that's what makes a good partnership in a way. You know, I think if I was trying to be out there and, like, I don't know. I mean, I have to do a lot of things if I was going to be out there. Every so often I think about, like, oh, do I want to, like, you know, figure out a way to be a thot? Like, transform myself into showrunner / thot, because would that be fun? But I don't want to be that famous.
You know what? I think you've nailed something here. You've nailed something here. You can do the work. I feel like the people who can do work without having to face the publicness of it all, the backlash, the, you know, the caps of it all have kind of nailed it. You are at the perfect intersection of where you're making your money, your peers know you, you're getting the opportunities, but you don't have to deal with the, you know, the shade roomness of it all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's like there's not a downside to that. I don't need to be more famous. I have friends who are famous. Like, one of my good friends is Lala Anthony.
Ah, yes.
I don't need that. You know what I mean? Like, she is, I think, so great at what she does and all the different things. She's a great actress and she's a wonderful human being and a great mom. Like, she's a superlative mother. And she puts all that energy into that, and I see that. And then we go out to dinner, and people have to interrupt the meal. Mm-hmm. They need to talk to her. They want to take a picture or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't want that necessarily, you know? And people do ask me for pictures and stuff, and, like, that's not – it's great. I appreciate the support. But I'm just saying that it's, for me, a thing where you don't necessarily want to invite that into your life. And I personally don't post pictures of my daughter online, because I don't want people to be mad that Ghost is dead and feel like they need to take it out on my kid.
Bro, can I just tell you, people really feel a lot of feelings about things, okay? And they really take it deep. Like, people feel a lot of feelings about TV shows and what happens. I'm just like, I know Tariq, the Michael Rainey Jr., who plays Tariq on Power, mm-hmm. he posts on mm-hmm. Instagram frequently that he gets death threats because people hate his character so much. And I'm mm-hmm. like, why is everybody this? I understand good storytelling. It's actually a testament to the good storytelling of the show. But people really do be mm-hmm. in their feelings. So I think it's an amazing idea that you don't post your daughter.
I actually want to talk about that a little bit, because, like, it's weird. I'm never in, like, a totally safe space to say this, but I feel like I'm in a safe space with you. I can say this. I really, really don't understand the people who feel like they need to put a death threat over the internet to a minor. Like, he was a minor at one point. He's 19 now. But, like, people were sending him that stuff when he was under 18.
Oh,
and then
God.
As an 18-year-old. Now, you're a grown-ass person and you need to threaten a kid?
Come
What's
on.
Wrong with you? Like, literally, fundamentally, something is wrong with you. Like, really wrong. Like, you need to go seek help, because it's not funny. It's not cute. That's a human being doing his job. And by the way, doing his job so well that you believe him.
Yes.
Keep in mind that most of these people, when they were 18 or 19 years old, couldn't hold down a full-time job.
Come on.
What are you talking about? Like,
come on.
Literally, what are you talking about?
Like, honestly, I'm in a state where I'm just like, this is maddening.
It is, but I feel protective because this is a child who's grown up under my watch.
Mm.
He was 11 years old when I hired him.
Wow.
11, he's a fifth grader.
Wow.
And these grown-ass men threatening a kid. This is like this guy, there was this guy who threatened to, like, rape and murder Leela because of when Angela arrested Ghost at the end of season 3, he, like, sent her, it was like a, you know, he thought it was ha 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 funny, joke. The FBI got involved. It was like a whole thing because he was like, he thought it was funny. Like, but she hadn't done anything. Leela went to work. She showed up, she took a shower, she learned her lines, she went to work. I wrote that Angela had arrested Ghost. By the way, all fake people who don't actually exist. Like, it is so frustrating to me. I understand. I'm thankful so much for people being passionate about the show. But it is a television show.
Yeah,
it
please relax.
It is a television show.
Everybody
and
relax.
It's a place that people work. Relax. Take it down about 10 to 15 notches. Like, really.
Yes. Oh, my God. Like,
also, the people who write on my Instagram, worst writing ever. You're a terrible writer because Ghost is dead. No, I'm a great writer because you're mad about it.
Yes.
I don't care if you don't like it, but your passion about it actually proves my point. And that was the whole thing, is that anybody could have stopped him at any time and yoked him up, but he thought he was unstoppable. He showed no humility before God, and that's what happened.
He kept on saying, no one can stop me. He kept saying it. He was like, nobody can stop me. At that point, pride comes before the fall, which is pride came before that
literally.
Fall. So,
literally, I showed a fall, y'all. This
yes,
is, like, I didn't make this stuff up.
Literally, like, pride came before the fall.
Literally, like, I'm not even that good. Like, I'm a hack. Like, I straight up had him fall down. Like, he literally fell. Like, what are you talking about? Like, it's just so funny. So it's like, I don't know. It's all biblical. I didn't make anything up. It's biblical. It's Shakespearean. It's all those things. I loved it.
And I was watching Power so proud that a Black woman was behind this work. I saw, like, the quality was amazing. It was, everybody was so in their feelings because the writing was so good. And that just brought me so much pride because your work did everything that people might have thought it couldn't have done. And as you're doing this, you mentioned Lala. How do you, like, what is the group that supports you? Who are the people that see you in the quiet moments?
Well, I have a spiritual community. So my spiritual community is, you know, that's my dog. you know, Lala is important to me. Gabriella Uribe, who is one of my writers, she was my assistant the first 2 years of Power. She's a genius and has been in my corner. I had a friend, Shanta, who was with me for a long time. Like, I just had, like, a lot of really close female friends, like my tribe of women, for sure. They've been great. And my mom, really supportive. You know, my brother. I've been very fortunate.
What do you think is the thing that you're proudest of that you've done so far in your career or in your life in general?
This is a cliche, but I made a person. Mm. I made a generous, kind person who, you know, is, like, talented and sweet and smart and loving.
Mm. That's real. It's not. I don't think it's cliche if it's true. I don't think it's cliche if it's true. So as you were doing all of this TV dominating, writing, all this good stuff, running shows, there's 5 shows coming, spinoffs of Power, which is wild. That's basically like SVU level, but that's Law and Order level. How are you taking care of yourself?
Oh, boy. I have to put in an endorsement for my next 90 days planner. I have to, from Savor Beauty. That thing is dope. I've been using that. I work with spiritual programs, so that is obviously, that's the essence of self-care. Having a relationship with a higher power is pretty much, like, fundamental. Prayer, meditation, writing. I like a massage.
Yes. 90 minutes, 60 minutes. What you doing?
What?
Are you doing 90 minutes or 60 minutes?
Of what? Meditation?
Of massage.
Oh, massage. Oh, 2 hours if I can get it, girl.
2 hours?
90 is a mess. Yeah, 2 hours if I can get it, for sure. I carry my tension to my shoulders, so they need to be worked out. Bath. I love a bath. I like things that smell good. I love beauty, like I told you. I like to give myself a facial now and then. I don't know. I like to watch Murder, She Wrote reruns.
Murder. That's very auntie of you. That is very Black auntie of you.
I am a Black auntie. I am a Black auntie. First of all, I have a nephew, but second of all, I am an auntie. I mean, look, I'm 42 right now, so I'm auntie age for sure.
So, favorite face products, because I'm all into the serums and the moisturizers. I always want to know what people are using on their face that you love.
Okay, well, I could go on forever, but I think the number one big change in my skin life that's happened recently is Sunday Riley CEO face oil.
Yes, the vitamin C serum.
Yes, the vitamin C serum, like the oil. Yeah, and then there's a serum. Those two products will change your skin. And then Good Genes, also by Sunday Riley, at night is like, that is a whole other step up. My skin is bright. It's glowing. Like, my skin is so different now because of that.
I'm trying to tell people. I'm like, y'all step this game up. Vitamin C serums is game changing. And Sunday Riley's whole line, including Good Genes, which is the lactic acid. Look, everything. It is worth all the monies.
It's worth all the money. And by the way, I'm telling you, even if you can afford one of those products, even one, even just Good Genes will change your skin. Like, applied religiously, will change your skin. People sleep on them. They don't understand that Sunday Riley is like, that's the truth. I mean, I would totally, I stan them.
Stan them. And if in case people are worried about the pricing, just remember, this lasts you like 6 to 8 months. So I think it's like $90. Look, you won't have to buy another one for another 6 months. I'm telling you, it's worth the money. Courtney, how can people support you now? What is your next thing? The power's done. Is there anything you can tell us about?
Well, there's the spinoff of Power. I am starting to work on an HBO series about cops. So that's really fun. The way I love support is, you know, people follow me on Instagram, on Twitter. I'm starting to think about my next phase. Speaking of the Writers Guild, we may go on strike pretty soon.
Oh, wow.
Which will definitely disrupt everybody's television and film watching. But if we do go on strike, I'm definitely going to start to really think about beauty and writing. I started a couple short stories just to keep creative, because it can get very easy to make this into a job, as you probably know.
Yeah.
It starts with something you love, and then it becomes a job. And you're like, oh, I got to do this for my job, as opposed to I get to do this for my job.
Right.
Remaining grateful, remaining humble, you know, that's so important. So giving time to create, I think, to really write and still do writing exercises, still open up bird by bird, still open up writing down the bones, still open up, you know, different kinds of writing, prompting exercises, and still doing those exercises, even when you don't want to, even when you're tired. You know, I guess I'd speak to all the writers out there, but I think this is true of anybody who wants to do anything, which is do a little bit of it every day. Like, don't say, okay, I'm going to do my day job Monday through Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday I'm going to write, because Saturday and Sunday you're going to have other things to do.
Facts.
Take a moment at your day job. Take your lunch break. Figure out a way. And this is a hard thing for a lot of people, but the truth is, there is a moment where you're awake and your kids are asleep. Mm. There is that moment. It does exist. What are you doing with that time?
Hmm.
Because that time is, that's the time that you need. So if, for example, your kids go to bed at 8, if you can stay up until 10, what could you do with that 2 hours?
Bang.
What could you do with that 2 hours? And some nights it's going to be time with your spouse. Of course it is, or with your significant other. But sometimes that 8 to 10, you got to figure out how half an hour of that is you doing something towards the thing you want to do.
And that right there is how you drop the mic. Courtney, thank you so much for coming on the show. This interview just gave me all the life.
Thank you for having me. You're amazing.
I'm just such a huge fan of your work, and I'm looking forward to whatever the next thing you're doing. And I'll let people know where to find you on social media. You're awesome.
Thank you. You're awesome. Are you kidding me? You've been awesome forever. That's the thing that people don't know. Lovie has been like this forever. She is the truth. I should just make a commercial for you is what I should do.
Listen, I think I'm like, one day, I'm just waiting for one day where I'm going to ask you, like, Courtney, can I just come sit at your feet and watch you do something for like a day so I can just learn? One day, you'll get that phone call from me.
You're welcome anytime.
Yes.
You're welcome anytime.
Yes. Thank you so much. And we'll be in touch.
Okay, great. Thanks, honey. Bye.
Bye, Courtney.
Y'all, much love to Courtney Kemp for taking the time to join me on Rants and Randomness. Please follow her on social media. She's Courtney Kemp on Twitter and Courtney A. Kemp on Instagram. Courtney, CourtneyNey, and then A. Kemp, KEMP. Y'all stay safe and well out here. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. And much love to Chicago Recording Company for partnering with me on this. Even recording from home during these times, they've got me sounding on point. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, wherever you want to, okay? And follow me on social media. I am @Lovie everywhere. See you on the next episode.